Our guest now says she spent her life feeling like she doesn't belong. Olga Kazan grew up as a Russian Jewish immigrant in the Bible Belt oil town of Midland, West Texas. Through her childhood and teens, all she wanted was to fit in and to be as American as her classmates. Even when the family moved to Dallas, she could not shake the weird label. Now an award-winning journalist covering health for The Atlantic, Olga Kazan has written a book about why some people are made to feel weird, and how some weirdos come to feel comfortable in their own skin, and how being an outsider can be an advantage. She's interviewed dozens of successful people who've been labelled weird at some point in their lives, including an orthopaedic specialist with dwarfism, a male kindergarten teacher, and a female racing car driver. Her book is called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga Kazan is with us from Dallas, Texas. Olga, welcome to 9 to Noon.
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
So you were a child when your family moved to Midland, Texas. What do you remember about this very sudden change in environment?
Yeah, you know, it's a very unique place. It's very overwhelmingly evangelical Christian, which my parents were not. There weren't any other Russian speakers there. I just felt like we were super different from everyone else in the town. And, that feeling kind of only grew over time. We kind of never really adapted to Midland, and Midland never really adapted to us.
Was it a place that had many immigrants? We think, of course, of the United States. It's a country in its modern iteration built on immigration, and some of the big cities, that diversity, including European migrants, goes back years. But what of Midland, Texas? Was it a place where there were many migrants?
There were immigrants from Mexico there, but not any from Russia or other countries that aren't Spanish-speaking.
So how would this manifest for you? Presumably often it would be other kids in class saying things, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, it was other kids in class, people trying to come to our house and convert us to Christianity, just kind of me not knowing different American cultural references and, references about like American football and things like that. But it's a feeling that kind of stayed with me just because some of those early experiences that you have in life can be so formative.
What brought the family to this part of America in particular?
So my parents are, like a lot of Russian immigrants in the U.S., are refugees. At the end of the 1980s, there was a big exodus of Russian Jews from the Soviet Union. And we were kind of brought to the U.S. And supposed to be resettled in areas where there are lots of other Jews in order to avoid exactly what happened to me. We were supposed to be with other Jewish people, and we were originally. We landed in LA, but the problem was that the job opportunities were just not as good in LA as they were in this booming oil town in West Texas. Less than a year after we arrived in LA, in Los Angeles, we moved to Midland.
What were the effects of this particular experience of childhood? Childhood throws many curveballs at us. Bullying is regrettably a very common experience. But this particular kind of interaction that you would have with others, how did it impact on you?
Yeah, well, I think one thing is that I became kind of sort of an observer, less of a, some people say like, oh, you're not really a joiner. Like I never joined like a sorority or a fraternity later on in life. I always felt like I was a little bit on the outside of, or on the periphery of, whatever was going on. I always felt a little bit like I was kind of just watching it all instead of taking part. And I think honestly, that's what kind of set me up to be a journalist, because that's a very natural feeling for a journalist to have, to feel like they should just be kind of on the side documenting it all instead of participating. So I think I was sort of trained for that role from a very early age.
How hard did you try to fit in inverted commas, and how did that affect your sense of self?
Well, at one point I let myself be baptized in a swimming pool. So I guess that affected my sense of self because I agreed to be part of a religion that I didn't really subscribe to. So yeah, I would do things like that. I would sort of go with the flow as much as I could. And that's another, I mean, I talked to a lot of people who were immigrants or people of different religions living in kind of homogenous areas. And that was sort of a common thing, is like to just go along with whatever the majority happened to want to do, and not make too many waves.
That can leave you feeling a bit like an actor, though, can't it?
Yeah, it does. It definitely estranged me a lot from Russian culture. I really, unlike a lot of Russians that live in the US today, I really don't probably speak Russian as well as they do, and I don't have a ton of Russian friends, and I kind of am not really Russian anymore.
Your father seems a larger-than-life character. Tell us about one incident in particular, where the kids went to quite some extremes to let you know you were an outsider, and how your dad responded.
I'm trying to think.
This is
Oh,
this is
well,
the
there
toilet
was.
paper incident.
Oh yeah. So one time, yeah, th that time. At one point in high school, our house got wrapped in toilet paper. I don't know if you guys do that there, but here that's how kids let you know that you're not popular, that you're sort of the loser, is they toilet paper your house. And my dad was actually really excited about this because he loves it when things are free. So he just saw this as free toilet paper, and he gathered it off the trees and stashed it in like plastic bags and used it as his own personal stash of toilet paper for the rest of the year.
Which is kind of a bit of a message back to those who'd provided it in the first place. I don't know if that's how he intended it, but
Yeah,
he
exactly.
sounds like a character. But what was your parents' experience of this? It's very different, of course, when you're older and you've got a very different perspective. How did they deal with this?
I think in Midland they actually dealt with it a little bit better than so they now live outside of Dallas. And I think they in Midland it was sort of slightly better. They did make sort of some friends, in part because their jobs were more social, and people in Midland are just so friendly. Now they have sort of not really integrated. They don't really have any friends, and they kind of stick to themselves a lot. So I think it is something that they just sort of decided that they were never going to connect with Texans, and they sort of failed to do that.
What is it that allowed you over time to come to realize that there's an upside to being different from everyone around you? And did you need the perspective of adulthood yourself to get there?
Yeah, I think a couple things. I mean, one is just I moved to an area where people who are different are just a lot more accepted. So I live in outside Washington, D.C. now, and it's just a city filled with people who move here because were the captain of their debate team, or they had some quirky thing about them that they wanted to like share with the world through their public service job. So it's full of people like that, and full of a lot of immigrants, obviously. So I don't really quite feel as weird anymore. But also, I think it did. I also have a job that benefits from kind of having an unusual perspective, and you kind of get rewarded for seeing angles that nobody else does, and being able to come up with sentences that no one else can come up with, and sort of, being creative or unusual in that way. So after a while, I kind of started to realize that maybe some of this kind of weirdness that I always felt was actually part of what was making me successful.
As part of your research, what did you learn about how being an oddball or a social reject or an outsider or whatever the terms are that get used is linked to creativity?
Yeah, I mean, was one of the most interesting studies that I found, which is that so these researchers invited people into a lab, and they just told some of them, "You're not chosen to be part of the group. You're rejected." So there wasn't really a group. They just wanted to make some of the participants feel kind of a little bit snubbed, right? And then they had them all do these exercises on paper. So they would have to figure out like what unites a group of words like fish, mine, and rush, so that the answer is gold. or to draw an alien from a different planet. And so the people who were rejected, who were told like, you're not popular, essentially, were better at both kinds of problem solving. Like just feeling that sense of you're not chosen to work part of a group made them write, you know, connect the words better and to draw more interesting aliens. And so they think that might be because once you have that sense that I'm not part of the group, you can kind of make up your own rules and it actually lets you become more creative.
There's an inhibition. And I'm curious if you think back to those sororities that you didn't join, there is an inhibition that comes with having to go along with the expectations of a group.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, you know, a big part of the book that I write about is that, you know, we all have norms. Of course, journalists have norms and I follow the norms of journalism. So it's not like only sororities have norms, you know, but the tighter groups that you're in, the kind of strict groups that have a lot of rules, you know, things like sororities and fraternities, they're going to limit the kinds of things that you do, you know, at least during the time that you're a member. So you know, you might not have the opportunity to be as weird as you might have otherwise because you're, you know, kind of following a standard set of norms that are laid out for you.
Is it often the outsider who goes against the flow and in doing so discovers or reveals something?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I found is actually that outsiders would often discover something about themselves. So one thing that I found, this was actually, it was a guy who went on a Mormon mission trip to Bulgaria. And there were just no Mormons there. He felt like such an outsider. Everyone was sort of, you know, he would try to convert people and they would be like, you know, stop talking to me. I'm not interested in being a Mormon. He actually started having doubts and having to like sort of explain Mormonism constantly to people and having to kind of wrestle with his outsider status in this country actually made him start questioning his beliefs more deeply. And it actually led to him leaving the Mormon church because he kind of came to understand something about himself through this process of like, you know, not just going with the flow and going along to get along, but having to actually justify himself to everyone that he met.
How did you choose the dozens of people that you interviewed? You were looking for successful people, for people who were had got ahead and were living the lives they wanted, despite how they may have been treated by others. But how did you choose whose stories you'd tell?
Yeah, I wanted to find people who were essentially different from everyone else around them because of some really important marker that they couldn't easily change. So it's not like they always wore a, you know, interesting looking hat because you can, you know, take off a hat. But so, for example, I talked to this transgender mayor in New Hope, Texas, which is another really small, you know, conservative town. And, you know, this was a really kind of tough thing for her to kind of come out as transgender. There weren't any transgender elected officials in that town. And, you know, she kind of had to, you know, introduce the town to this concept. And, you know, at one point she described herself as being like, you know, the map of all the stores in the mall where you show people kind of like, here's what a transgender person is and here's what I'm all about. And that, you know, I wanted to find people like that who were sort of like these fish out of water that couldn't really easily leave the water that they were in and also couldn't really stop being fish.
Let's talk about some of them then and what they told you about their paths. For example, I mentioned in the introduction the leading orthopedic specialist with dwarfism. What did you learn from him about what both the barriers were, but how he not only overcame them, but perhaps turned his situation and or his outsiderness into something positive?
Yeah, I mean, that was, so this is Michael Ain. He was one of the most interesting, he was one of the first people that I encountered that kind of got me thinking about this whole concept of outsiders. But his situation was so extreme because the only thing different about him is his height. So he's not, you know, disabled in any way other than his height. You know, he has a very obviously high IQ, everything, you know, very qualified to be a surgeon. But he, when he was applying to med schools and to surgery programs, he was rejected from dozens of them just because back when he was applying in the 80s, it was thought that short people couldn't be doctors, that you had to be tall to be a doctor, which sounds really silly, but it just shows you how limited we can be in thinking about, you know, norms and how important they are, and ableism, frankly. So he honestly, I was so surprised by this, but he just persevered. He sent out, you know, instead of sending out 20 applications that all got rejected, he would send out the 21st. You know, he kept trying. He veered into pediatrics for a while because he was getting rejected from all these surgery programs. And he finally made it, and he actually became a surgeon who helped children with, you know, the different spinal issues that people with dwarfism often have. So he would kind of paid it forward to other people like him, since he knew what it was like to be kind of mistreated in that way. And I thought that was really cool that he kind of didn't let all of that adversity get him down, but also really unusual because I am not sure that I have it in me to write, you know, 21 med school applications when everyone's, you know, kind of discounting me on such a silly, silly reason.
So is persistence one trait that you would identify? And second, what role self-esteem, because this behavior can erode, not only make one feel like an outsider, but can erode someone's sense of self-worth. Did you find a commonality that despite what they might have experienced, the people you interviewed had a strong sense of their own self-worth and self-esteem?
Yeah, I mean, I have one chapter where I really talk about this, but that's definitely something that I noticed through all the characters, is that they were just so sure they were on the right path, and they didn't let all of the haters, in other words, get them down. And even when really painful things happened, so one of the people I interviewed was a male preschool teacher who was wrongly accused of sexual abuse, and the accuser kind of used his gender against him and was basically like, look at him, he's a man, like he's touching children inappropriately. And that was something like that's like a huge taboo for male early childhood educators. That's a very common thing to be kind of, you know, foisted at them or to be like whispered about, even though it's not common that they actually do that. Of course, it's just like sort of a kind of a way to discredit them. So he was really crushed and crestfallen to be discredited in that way. And he, you know, kind of had to find a way to pick himself back up after that. Like that's pretty much the worst thing that could happen in your career as an early childhood educator. And he eventually, you know, found a way to square that with the fact that he still really liked the work and wanted to keep going.
What you also found, and you alluded to it earlier, is that often there's a strong link between the out-of-the-box thinking or the creativity of those who feel like outsiders. And we talked about how that might come. You're not afraid of swimming against the mainstream because the mainstream's already told you you're not in it, right? Did your research suggest any other reasons as to why, whether it was solutions to word and conceptual problems or whether it was, you know, the creative arts, there seems to be this link?
Between creativity and...
the sense of being an outsider or being treated as an outsider.
Yeah, I wonder if one reason is just that a lot of these people spent a lot of time alone as kids and, or just sort of, you know, they didn't fit in with their peers, or they were already so into whatever the unique thing they were doing. So Julia Landauer, the female race car driver that I talked to, was racing go-karts when she was, you know, 10 years old, 11 years old. So it's, her whole life is racing, and just her whole vocabulary is all about race cars. So I think she just had such a single-minded focus on it from childhood that maybe that's what made her so good. Like, you know, at the same time that it set her apart from her peers and did kind of make her different from other girls, it also made her better at what she was doing.
Did many of them indicate whether they'd got to the point where they regarded their outsiderism as a bonus or if they had the chance, they would not have gone through what they'd gone through and perhaps still went through. Were any clear on that?
Yeah, I don't think anyone said explicitly that they wish they hadn't gone through what they went through. I think most of them had found a way to feel at peace with whatever had happened. And some of them had been through some really tough stuff. I'm thinking especially of this woman I interviewed who escaped the Amish and was now kind of an ex-Amish girl living in the, you know, regular modern world. She had gone through so many awful challenges and horrible things. I'm sure she wishes that some of that path was easier or not as, you know, traumatic, but I don't think, you know, even she didn't say, I wish I had never been Amish or something like that. I think they all saw it as part of the character building process and part of, you know, what makes them so sure about where they are now. I think if she had never been Amish, she wouldn't be so dedicated to being not Amish.
Another trait that appears common and perhaps logical you found in these success stories was their effectiveness at convincing others to listen to their ideas. That's kind of perseverance in a way, isn't it? But it's also a communication skill. And are they just simply more trained? Have they exercised that muscle more to communicate and to argue for their case and their cause?
Yeah, this is really something I noticed with this sociology professor that I talked to, who's quite liberal, you know, and she, again, Texas once again, she's actually teaching gender studies in the most conservative congressional district in the country, which is also in Texas. So she really had to get, you know, adept at explaining her ideas to people who might be resistant to them, or who might not have heard of this field of study, or who in general are just not very on board with her, you know, what she's teaching. So she really would try to change her curriculum around so that some of the early concepts that she would introduce to these folks were easier to digest. So something like, oh, well, here's, you know, masculinity and what it's all about. And, you know, you're familiar with John Wayne and here's, you know, like what you're familiar with Westerns and that's what masculinity is like. And then, you know, maybe from there they could go into feminism, you know, which tends to be kind of a taboo word in that part of the country. So, you know, they would kind of, she would kind of try to ease them in the shallow end before she fully brought on the heavy duty gender studies stuff, which I thought was like a really smart technique and something that she's learned just because she had had, you know, some tense moments with her students of where they didn't want to kind of pick up what she was putting down.
What have you learned also as part of your research into the human obsession with outsiders and creating them? What do some of the social sciences say about why we are so wary of people who are even a little bit different when they arrive in our communities?
Yeah, well, this has relevance to today, actually, which is that originally, or I guess not originally, but one theory is that, you know, ages and ages ago, we were concerned that people who behave differently or look different from, you know, what we expect people to look like or act like actually had diseases. And those diseases might've been the explanation for their behavior. So if you think about someone who has syphilis might, you know, in the late stages of that disease, you actually behave kind of crazy. and so people were actually wary of anyone who, you know, looked like they might have a mental illness, because that might mean they have syphilis. And of course, this isn't really rational. This is before we had germ theory and, you know, other ways of diagnosing illnesses. But it was sort of that, you know, medieval or kind of even before that kind of spidey sense or subconscious sense that, oh, I should stay away from this person. They're not acting normal. They might infect me and my whole community. They might be from far away and have diseases that, you know, I don't have immunity to. So, you know, and unfortunately, like we kind of saw some evidence of that with coronavirus here in the US because people started being really racist toward anyone who looked like they might be Asian. just because there was, you know, we knew that the virus had originally come from China. So unfortunately, that hasn't completely gone away.
How has what you've learned here and what you write here, how can this help people? And perhaps parents, teachers, friends, what they can say to someone who is being treated as an outsider that might have some impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, I feel like knowing about the problem is the first step. So hopefully it helps people understand a little bit more about why so many people like normalcy. You know, I think from there, I think, you know, hopefully can show them some positive stories of people who felt really different and overcame that. You know, hopefully help them feel like being weird is good and that there's nothing to be ashamed of if you're weird.
Olga, thank you. Olga Kazan, the book is Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World.